WILL appreciate the patience of our HD listeners as we work to correct this issue as quickly as possible. Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. You might have heard that our colleague, Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep, and a team of producers traveled along the entire U.S.-Mexico border. Along the way, they've brought us stories of the people, the products, and the cultural ideas that travel across the border. We had to get a piece of this for ourselves, so we asked Steve Inskeep to come on by, and he's with us now. Welcome.
Thanks so delighted to be here.
So what started this off?
I was reading a book which divided the United States culturally into 11 nations, you know, like Kurdistan would be a nation of sorts within Iraq, and they had all these different cultural zones in the book, like the Deep South or Appalachia, places you can recognize. And there was one that was particularly fascinating, labeled El Norte, the North. And it was the northern region of Mexico and the southwestern border of the United States, both sides of the border. And it argued in this book that it was one contiguous region, that the two sides of the border, for all the security and fear there, are more similar to each other than the country on either side. And I said, I want to see that. I want to explore that.
So
I want to get
at
news issues through, like immigration and other things, through that lens.
Okay, so the trip was like about a little over 2 weeks, traveling by car. Hopefully there was air conditioning.
Yes, there was
air conditioning involved. Yeah. So what stood out for you? I mean, you focused a lot on the people who were trying to cross the border. What stood out for you?
We were exploring stories of people crossing the border in different ways, not just people trying to migrate to the United States, people going the other direction, people trading. And one of the things that really stands out is that these two countries are interacting with each other every day. And in spite of the border fences or walls or whatever you want to call them, and helicopters in the air and security and fear on both sides of the border, these are two countries that are influencing each other all the time.
One of the things that stood out for me, though, and you focused on a number of people whose efforts to cross into the U.S. began well before the borders of Mexico. And this is something that I am not sure a lot of people know. And you found this out when you visited a shelter in San Benito, Texas. And I have a clip from a piece where you sat down with Sarah Zawedi Yilma, who is Ethiopian, traveled to Sudan, then flew to Sao Paulo, all the hopes of eventually making it to the U.S. And let me play that clip.
Brazil, Venezuela, I crossed a lot of countries.
Okay, so we're in Brazil here. We're in Sao Paulo.
Yes.
How'd you get from Sao Paulo to Venezuela?
Venezuela by car.
By car?
Yes.
So you're going through the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
You're going across the Amazon River at some point.
Yes, by car.
And you end up in Caracas, Venezuela.
Yes, Caracas, in the border of Colombia and Venezuela.
Then you went across westward to Colombia. Okay.
Yes, Colombia.
So, you know, just kind of boggles the mind. And I can't even capture like the poignancy of all this because she's married. She borrowed thousands of dollars from her sisters to make this trip. She and her husband, you know, are pregnant, but they're separated now because he's in a different shelter. So, I mean, how common a story was that?
It's more common than you might think. This story started, Michelle, because I heard a story of a taxi driver here in Washington, D.C., who was from Ethiopia and had come up through Mexico. And I wanted to know, how often does that happen? And we ended up in this shelter where there were people from around 20 different countries in recent months who had come to the United States. It became apparent there's a whole network of smugglers. I don't know, is it hundreds of people? Is it thousands of people? I don't know exactly how many come this way, but there are people from all over the world who find Mexico to be a way station on the way into the United States.
The stories of the people who were trying to come into the United States, was there a common thread?
There is economic desperation. There is a want of opportunity in the United States, and there is a desire to travel freely. Also, there's often a desire to connect with your family. We encountered children being stopped as they tried to cross the border, and that seems to be a very common thing. And it's believed a lot of these underage people who are often traveling unaccompanied or barely accompanied by adults are trying to join family members in the United States. That is one of the most poignant things that's happening right now.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep about his series of reports from the U.S.-Mexico border. He and a team of producers traveled the entire length of the U.S.-Mexico border, stopping to find out what was going on all along the way. Could you talk a little bit more about the children? I must say that that was one of the things about your pieces that I found really troubling. I mean, there was one story, there was a piece you talked about the children who were born in the U.S. but whose parents were deported to Mexico. So these children go to school in the U.S., but the school bus drops them off at the border. And you also talked about children who are traveling unaccompanied, or as you said, barely accompanied. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Unbelievable complexity of human lives. And you start asking a few questions of anybody, whether we're talking about Junior, a high school student outside El Paso on the Texas side whose father was deported, whether we're talking about kids that we saw being stopped as they tried to cross the border, whether we're talking about U.S. citizens who are children living in Mexico who get bused across to an American school. We would like to think of that border as this very firm demarcation. And if you like Law and Order, you might just like it if everybody stayed to their side of the border. But you discover how complicated family life is. And when you throw into that the complexities of immigration law and the complexities of the border, that firm line that we see on a map is not firm at all. And it's really hard for people to deal with.
You know, you were telling us, though, that there are a lot of people who are from Mexico or from the U.S. who live near there who've never been there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Why is that?
Well, there is also a great deal of fear, Michelle, of crossing the border because of the tremendous drug violence of recent years. It's not without reason, but maybe the reason has gone beyond the reality, if you understand what I'm saying. The fear has outlasted the reality. You would think perhaps this was an ethnic thing, that it would be Anglos who would be terrified of going to Mexico. But I found in our reporting, it extended to Mexican Americans who'd gone across the border in the past. It extended to Mexican nationals who were living in the United States who were terrified of the border region. And it's just there's a crossing. There's security. There's a fence. There are helicopters. It looks scary. And you stop going for a while because there was some violence. It's hard to start again. And that was a real challenge for people. And that is a reality also, is the present fear of crossing the border because of some present violence. I don't want to say it's totally safe, but also because of past extreme violence.
Because it's become kind of this place of mythology in a way.
Absolutely. Like, and as soon as you stop going, it's hard to start again. It's like crossing any kind of other psychological as well as real barrier.
But as you also pointed out, you know, culture knows no borders, right? And it's just that there's like cultural things happening, music and art, all kinds, back and forth.
Yeah, let me talk about this one group, Intocable, that we interviewed on the air. And I just want to mention something about the instrumentation of this group. Accordion is the classic sound of this conjunto music, which is a form of music that's heard up and down the border. And think about that. You've got this Central European instrument that is now a typical Mexican instrument. You also have this bajo sexto, this guitar. It's kind of a 12-string guitar, but it was developed in southern Mexico, and it's now a border thing. And you have groups from Texas that play this kind of music. And they're absorbing not just those traditional forms of music, but also rock music they heard on the radio in the last 10 or 20 years. And they're mixing it all together in this place where the culture mixes together. The music is a real clue to that.
Well, one of the people you interviewed, Ricky Munoz, talked about that. He's the lead singer for this group, Intocable. And he talked about how he sees this kind of these relationships going on in more ways than one. All right, here it is. I'll play that clip.
Sometimes we have the run-of-the-mill, you know, there's a white boy in the crowd, you know, sometimes. Like we play, like, for example, in Nashville, sometimes there's a white guy, like, standing there and, you know, sticking out there like a sore thumb, you know.
Looks like me, perhaps.
Exactly. But and after the show, they come and somehow, you know, they met probably this Mexicana, Señorita, and they knew our music, you know, they say, I don't understand a single word you're singing, but I guess they can relate to our music because it has that rock flavor, that country flavor, and it does speak like to the white people in some weird way.
Speaks to the white people, I guess. I guess it does. And others.
Well, and all kinds of people can be attracted to this music. Now, there is a barrier here, which he alludes to a little bit, and that is the language. And that is a barrier for some people. And singing in English, interestingly enough, is a barrier for Ricky Munoz. He grew up in the United States. Obviously,
he speaks perfect English, but you were saying he does very few interviews in English.
I don't think anybody's asked him ever to do an interview in English. And he's also been reluctant to try singing in English. He's not totally confident that he can pull it off. And he's not totally confident there's a market for his style of music with English lyrics. So there are some barriers that are harder to cross than others.
Mm. You know, I want to end our conversation where we started off, which is that there's a lot of, despite the fact that this border looms so large in our public debate and in our kind of consciousness around so many issues, that there's a lot of ignorance about the border and how life is really lived and so forth. Is there something that you really wish people would know when they think about this border.
I think when you think about the border and issues that have been talked about a lot, like immigration or crime or drugs, you can initially be turned off because you think, I know that issue. I've heard about that issue for years. But it's like looking at the surface of the ocean, Michelle, and it seems rather flat and placid and dull until you dive in. We wanted to dive in with this series and hear individual stories, and every one of these stories was more complicated than anybody's ideology that you hear about these issues. Real life is complicated. Border life is perhaps even more complicated. And what we found was several sides of the same political issue reflected in the personal story of any given individual. And it just underlined for me the importance of listening to people's stories, paying attention to reality and making decisions based on that rather than on a very simplified view of it.
Hmm. I'm sorry that you aren't going to demonstrate a grito for us.
No, you're not. You? If I tried to demonstrate, you would be sorry then. You would be sorry.
No, I really want to hear it.
Well, okay.
It's a grito. Tell us. It's a.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Tell
we went to this grito contest. It's basically a shouting contest, a Mexican shouting contest, although it was won by an Anglo.
I'm from New York. You cannot scare me.
The women howled better than the men, but it's about trying to shout as long as you can. Hi! Yay. That'd be a very short grito, what
Pretty
I just
good.
Did. Thank you, thank
Pretty
you.
Pretty good. Excellent.
But I'd have to go much longer in order to win the contest.
Steve Inskeep is a host of NPR's Morning Edition. He was kind enough to walk down the hall and join us in our studios here in Washington, D.C. Steve Inskeep, thanks so much for joining us.
Invite me back anytime.
If you want to hear more from Steve Inskeep's trip to the borderland, go to npr.org. This week, NPR will publish a digital magazine. It will have everything about the U.S.-Mexico border, the sights, the sounds, the facts, all in one place. Just ahead, Deborah Jiang Stein's parents wanted to protect her, so they didn't tell her she was adopted or that she was born in a prison. But all that secrecy took its toll, and the price turned out to be high.
You know, I was filled with so much self-hate before I even knew these facts. So adding on to I'm a different color, I'm from prison, all of it I turned on myself.
She tells us her story and how she changed the ending. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
By his late 20s, my father sold bricks of Mexican reefer every weekend. By the time he was 30, he moved hundreds of pounds a month in the trunk of an old Buick.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Tony DeCopel tells the story of how he learned that his father was a major drug smuggler. His new memoir is called The Last Pirate. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from the Auto Mall of Champaign on Moreland Drive, a new car alternative offering hundreds of late model vehicles, including luxury sedans, family minivans, and SUVs. A listing of cars and trucks available is on the web at automallofcu.com. The Auto Mall invites you to join them in supporting WILL.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Now it's time to go behind closed doors. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters that many people prefer to keep private. Today we want to talk about what it means to know where you come from. Now, a lot of Americans believe that a lot of the problems in this country and, frankly, many of the conflicts outside of it stem from people who are too tied to their roots, to their religion or ethnic identity or race. But our next guest has a very different take on that. She wants us to reflect on the toll of being disconnected from your roots, even when they are less than ideal. For Deborah Jiang Stein, the beginning of her life was shrouded in secrets. She didn't know she was adopted until a cousin broke the news to her at a family gathering. She was never told why nobody else in her white Jewish family shared her dark skin and almond-shaped eyes. But there was an even bigger secret at the heart of her family's story that involved where she was born. She talks about all of this in a recent essay for the website XO Jane and in her new memoir, Prison Baby. And Deborah Jiang Stein is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me on.
Your adoptive parents gave you what sounds like a good childhood. You know, you had French lessons and ballet and swimming and trips to museums. But you describe always feeling out of place. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Before I knew any facts, I knew that I was different. I could see that visually. And I also think just innately, I knew that there was something deeper than what I knew beyond just being adopted.
How did you figure out that you were born in prison? As I understand, you didn't find out until you were 12.
Right, and I didn't figure it out. I landed on a letter that my mother wrote, probably well-intended, but, you know, I was pre-puberty, which isn't good for anything, and I found this letter, and it sent me into a tailspin. She wrote a letter asking the attorney to change my birthplace. You know, I don't have the letter now, but I remember it enough. She wanted to remove any records that my birth mother was a heroin addict, and there was mention of foster care. So I knew nothing about that.
Hmm. Were you ever able to ask her why it was so important to her to hide the fact that you were born in prison?
I did later on, once I went through, you know, wildlife between finding out and approaching her. And all she could say was, we were worried what would happen to you. And I said, well, mother, look what did happen.
What did you find out, or what were you able to find out about why your mother was in prison and why you were born there?
After a lot of research and getting her prison documents and returning to the prison, I learned that more than just being a heroin addict, she had spent most of her life in and out of prisons and jails, starting in reform school as a teen. And so she was doing what addicts do. And on one of her many sentences, she was pregnant and the prison didn't know what to do with me. And I was allowed to stay with her for a year, which is kind of the quirky part. Now we have 11 prisons around the country with nurseries keeping the babies on the compound. But, you know, the backdrop of my life is the 60s. They did not know what to do with me, and I don't have a complaint about it because I believe I was surrounded by love, and I don't think a baby knows what a prison is.
She wanted you with her.
She did, but what I read was there was this dilemma, and I recently met with incarcerated women who are pregnant, and I see that dilemma as well. They want to keep their children and then at the same time want a better life for their children, and so she wavered. Her documents show that one day she wanted to keep me, and another day she'd say, can you remove the baby and find a good home for her? So she was conflicted.
You were telling us that as a child, even though your physical circumstances were pretty comfortable, that it was tough for you. I mean, you were called, you know, the N-word on the school bus. And, you know, when you told your adoptive mother, she didn't seem to know how to respond. Could you talk a little bit about that?
You know, I was filled with so much self-hate before I even knew these facts. So adding on to I'm a different color, I'm from prison, I have this addiction in the background, which I didn't know much about as a child. All of it I turned on myself and also blamed everyone else for. I mean, that was really the story. The secret is I blamed myself for it and hated everyone else for it. And my parents just did not have the resources and weren't able to talk about it. I mean, even throughout their life, they weren't.
At the time that you were growing up, parents didn't talk about a lot of things with their kids. I mean,
right. They
barely talked about sex. They didn't talk about illness. You know, when people got cancer, they'd call it the big C. There was all kinds of stuff back, you know, when you were growing up, that people just did not talk about. And people thought that was better.
Right, that secrecy was better.
Yeah.
But to me, if there's stigma or shame, it exists whether we hide it or not. And so I think it's better to just face the demon, whatever it is, and be able to walk with it or overcome it instead of hide it in a back pocket. And so I'm proof of that. I hid that. I never told anyone for 20 years that I knew I was born in prison. But it leaked out like this poison everywhere. It was when I could start to say it, which is really only some years ago, outside of prisons. I never was very public about it until recently, that I realized I could put it in a certain place and not have it conquer me.
You write about the fact that you acted out a lot as a child. You started using illegal drugs in the seventh grade. And it kind of, how would you describe yourself in this period?
A thug in the making is what I say. You know, at the time I was probably called a juvenile delinquent. I don't know that consciously I was trying to be like my birth mother, but my relationship to the world was one of rage. And so whatever I could do to hurt myself and others really felt like the only satisfying way to walk in the world. I know now is masking pain and sorrow.
So you were using drugs, and then in your late teens, you started selling drugs. You
right,
were even
selling
smuggling
drugs,
them.
Running, mm-hmm,
right,
smuggling drugs, carrying weapons. I joined a gang. I mean, I was just doing whatever I wanted. I felt like I was outside the confines of any society. So I was doing whatever I wanted with whomever.
You know, amazingly, you never got locked up yourself.
I know, isn't that amazing? And I don't brag about that. I was speaking in a prison the other day because I talk about this in front of law enforcement. So I'm not bragging. I've been close to being caught. I've been caught, but I've never been incarcerated.
Well, what made you finally clean up your act?
I don't know that I have one turning point. There's a couple of things I know. I was scared. I'd been witness to a stabbing. I knew I was mentally not well, and I was physically ill. I knew I needed to change. And I knew I couldn't do it alone. As much as I hated to ask for help, I knew I needed help.
So what did you do? You got yourself clean. I mean, that wasn't an easy process. I don't want people to think that this was kind of this linear, like you woke up one day and all of a sudden you were clean. There were many relapses. There were many twists and turns. Yeah. What did you then decide to do? Like, how did you then kind of redirect?
My first direction was I ran away. I left the West Coast, where I grew up in Seattle, and I moved to the Midwest because I thought nothing bad will happen in the Midwest, right? Well, suddenly I'm surrounded by the same kind of people, the same drugs, and I figured out that, and it's not that hard, that wherever I went, I was bringing the same problems because the same things kept happening. So I had that insight that I was part of the problem instead of everyone else, and that was a turning point.
In hindsight, because you're a parent yourself now, what do you think would have been better? If your adopted parents had told you from the beginning, what do you think would have been better?
You know, I'm asked that an awful lot. I wish I knew the complete answer. I don't know the exact right time to tell a child, but I think not hiding it is the best time. I also think if when I was little, I was introduced to formerly incarcerated women, even though they were outside of the lifestyle of my parents, and if I had met former drug addicts, I could have put a face on that instead of thinking these are the beginnings of a monster and I was the monster.
Do you think in hindsight that part of what you were made to feel shame about was being born in prison or was it being of a different race? I mean, transracial adoption at the time you were growing up was pretty rare.
Right. I think it's definitely both. So together it was a bomb. But I learned that my parents wanted to adopt what was called then and still is a special needs and at-risk kid. They at one point were looking at adopting a Native American girl. So my parents were the kind of people that voted for Dick Gregory for president, right? And so they were kind of out there in their liberalness, and they sought that deliberately, which actually really irritated me for a while.
How come?
Because I felt like I was their tool for liberalness.
A project. Not a person.
Right. Yeah.
Did you ever get a chance to talk to them about this and ever get a sense of understanding from them why they never wanted to talk about it? I just wonder whether this was ideological or emotional. You know what I mean?
Oh, it's totally emotional. My dad kind of thought it was interesting that I was looking for my roots. My mother was deeply hurt by it, and so I backed away. And I realized that I'm doing my search for myself, not to prove anything to her, and not for a need any longer to reject her. And so when I saw her discomfort when I said, I found out I was born in prison, and she said, oh, we were so worried what would happen. And I could see by her body and she was turning red and she was so uncomfortable. And I think behind that, just sadness. You know, as a parent, you grieve when your kids grieve. And she didn't want me to have that pain, but I couldn't help but have that pain when I was younger.
What would you like people to learn from your story?
I think telling our stories as fully as possible, at least to one person, kind of reduces the secrecy and the shame about anything. It doesn't have to be about prison or race. I mean, my story really isn't just a prison story. It's a family story about healing and finding a journey of wholeness. And I find everybody relates to that. Everybody has a secret.
Could we wind up where we started the conversation? This whole question of there are a lot of people who feel in this country that we're just too much involved with these kinds of issues, you know, race and, you know, that people just spend too much time thinking about it. And your story is very much kind of a warrant for, you know, just saying that you need to know where you come from, that that matters. Can you talk a little bit more about why?
So I answer a question with a question when people ask me that. How can we be whole if we don't look at the broken pieces? And if we pretend it doesn't exist, I don't think we'll ever find solutions. And I feel like I personally am evidence of that. And my work in prisons is evidence of that. If we won't have conversations about what doesn't work, we won't find what does work.
Deborah Jiangstein is the author of the memoir Prison Baby. She's also an advocate for incarcerated women and the founder of the Unprison Project. And she was kind enough to join us from Minnesota Public Radio. Deborah Jiangstein, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now we hear from a man who says a relationship he built with a prison inmate changed his own life for the better. Actor Hill Harper documented his friendship and the advice he shared in his book, Letters to an Incarcerated Brother. When we spoke with him about the book last year, we also spoke with him for the regular feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we invite some of our guests to tell us about the songs they've been listening to. And he told us about what he listens to when he wants to unwind.
Hi, I'm Hill Harper, and this is what's playing in my ear.
Dorothy was a waitress on the promenade. She worked a night shift. Dishwater blonde, tall and fine. She got a lot of tips.
There's an old song by Prince, and when people think about Prince's music, I don't think they ever think about this song, but it's without question my favorite Prince song for a reason. It's called Dorothy Parker. And he says in the song, you know, Dorothy was a waitress on the promenade. She worked the night shift. Dishwater blonde, tall and fine. She got a lot of tips. And it's this beautiful story song, basically extolling his love and beauty of this waitress named Dorothy Parker. And for whatever reason, that song just touches a chord in me and it inspires me as an artist. And so I listen to that song a lot. The song is a song that's even older. It's Rick James, and it's Fire and Desire. And if you ever want to talk about passion and love, and you think of Tina Marie, and you think of Rick James, both of whom aren't with us anymore, and you listen to this song, Fire and Desire, and you just hear their voices, and you hear the passion, and you hear what's going on. And if you ever, ever, ever make love with music playing, this should be the song that you play on repeat.
Then I kissed your lips and you turned on my fire, baby. And you burned me up within your flame. Took me a little higher.
Folks don't like to talk about the music they play when they make love, but listen, let's just be honest. Sometimes the music makes it better. So Fire and Desire, put that on your playlist.
Boy, I'm about my business on business. I drink liquor on liquor. I have women on women. Yeah, that's bump, baby. I done lived more than an 80-year-old man still kicking, because they live for some moments, and I live for a living.
But last but not least, since I kind of went old, I want to bring it contemporary. Kendrick Lamar is a young man, and I couldn't be more impressed with his intellect. And he has a song called Control, where he's actually a guest on it. It's a Big Sean song, and I'm going to say a couple of the lyrics. He's basically claiming his greatness.
I'm Machiavelli's offspring. I'm the king of New York. king of the coast. One hand, I juggle them both. The juggernauts all in your juggler. You take me for jokes. Live in the basement.
There's one line that I love. He said, if Phil Jackson came back, still no coaching me. I'm uncoachable. I'm unsociable. Forget your clubs. Forget your pictures. Forget your Instagram. Forget all of that. And he's basically saying, I'm going for it, and I'm going to be great, and I'm not going to try to conform to the status quo and the same norms, and you can't control me. And that's special because so many of us are so afraid to actually go big and go for it and go for our dreams and live big. And so I love it because it's basically hip-hop without extolling the virtues of bling, money, drugs, etc. And that's the direction I want hip-hop to go in. So I love you, Kendrick Lamar. Keep doing your thing.
I heard the barbershops being great debates all the time about who's the best MC, Kendrick, Jigga, and Nas.
That was actor Hill Harper telling us what's playing in his ear. To hear our previous conversation with him, just head over to NPR.org, click on the Programs tab, and then go to Tell Me More. Coming up, we hear how violinist Nishtha Raj is putting her twist on Indian classical music, adding new sounds like beatbox.
My goal was to really showcase Indian classical music in a way that is appealing to a wider audience, and so they can get an interest in it and find the beauty that I see in it.
Nishtha Raj talks about her musical journey and shares songs from her debut album, Exit One. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair, including the true black color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. From the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. And from the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. This is NPR.
Hi, I'm Donda Beard, WILL's Development Director.
And I'm John Steinbacher, Membership Director. It's almost time for our annual April Pledge Drive. Starting on April 5th, we'll be seeking to raise $140,000 in just 8 days.
It's a big goal, but the moment we reach $140,000, we'll end the drive.
Wait. Didn't we do that last year?
Yes, we did. And we were able to end our drive one day early.
Right. Yeah, let's do that again. And maybe we could also have a day where we let people donate on behalf of their pets. Come on, it'll be fun. I've heard that Steve Inskeep is very popular in the goat community.
Well, my dog Wally does love listening to Classic Mornings with Vic.
There you go. That's the spirit.
Okay, let's do it. But let's not lose sight of the real goal, which is to ensure that we can continue to provide great news, ag coverage, and classical music to our listeners.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by the U of I International Programs and Studies, celebrating International Week with Chai Time tonight at 6 p.m. at the Asian American Cultural Center and the Kiss a Boca Variety Show at 7 p.m. in the Illini Union Courtyard.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. When you think of Indian classical music, you probably don't expect to hear beatbox or strains of jazz and even rock, but that's exactly what Nishtha Raj is all about. That was Bhairavi Beatbox from Nishtha Raj's debut album, Exit One. She's mixing classical Hindustani music with modern sounds and bringing it to a new generation of music lovers. And that might have a bit to do with her own story, which we hope she'll tell us a little bit about. And Nishtha Raj joins us now for a special performance and conversation about her musical and life journey. She was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you mind introducing us to the other members of the band?
Sure. So today joining me, I have members of the jazz trio, The Fourth Stream, Shriram Gopal on drums, Jeffrey Rohrbach on piano, and Rob Colton on guitar, and we have Ethan Foote on bass. And then I also have on cello, Weitold, and human beatbox, Christals Bacon.
Thank you all so much for joining us. So how did you get interested in music to begin with?
As a child, I was just drawn to music, and I started learning a lot of the instruments at my temple where I would go all the time with my mom, and the music was very much something that I just felt like I wanted to learn, so I just picked up instruments at the temple, and then I formally started learning the violin when I was in the fifth grade at school. And I had an interest in Indian classical music, but growing up in Texas, there really wasn't an opportunity, especially to study Indian violin, so I started learning vocal, and I actually took a little bit of tabla classes just to get introduced to the music, and I actually applied to for a scholarship to go to India to study the music, and so once that happened, the music took me there, and ever since then, I never looked back.
How did your folks feel about it? Because they were immigrants.
Right.
And they had come this way.
Yeah.
I don't know. How did they feel about you going back the other way?
Right. So at first, it was an uphill battle. Both my parents were just like, why do you want to go to India to study music? Because they worked so hard to come here, like you were saying. And so they were just really confused about that. But I think they eventually saw my passion and how much I really loved the music and what it meant to me. And it wasn't easy going to India. Like growing up here, I had so many comforts around me. And then living in India, it was tough. You know, Delhi is not a very safe city for women as well. And I gave up a lot of comforts to be there. But the music was so fulfilling. It kept me there for a number of years and really just gave me so much.
How did people there feel about your coming there? I mean,
yeah.
What are you doing
yeah,
here?
So I would meet a lot of people and they
were
just very confused why I would do that, because to them I left the American dream, basically. They all want to come to America, and so they were shocked that I came all that way to study music. But I think people appreciated it too.
So let's play something for us, if you would. And
sure.
I think one of the songs on your album is a cover of a famous Bollywood hit.
The song is called Ik Pyar Ka Nagma Hai. It's from a Bollywood film from the 70s called Shore. I used to listen to this song with my mom as a child growing up. And it has a very simple meaning. The lyrics talk about how life is just so short and you have to really grab the moments with those that you love, because you never know when they'll go away. And my mom's passed away now. It's been about 7 years. And I really couldn't listen to the song after she passed away. But then I decided I wanted to make peace with it and created this arrangement of the song. And it's a piece of my heart, really.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, we are having a special in-studio performance and conversation with violinist Nishtha Raj. Her debut album is titled Exit One. Why Exit One?
So I was thinking about how I feel towards music, and it's always been a journey for me, something that I'm traveling on. Exit One is sort of implying that it's been my first stop on the journey. I worked with so many wonderful musicians. All the tracks kind of represent all the stops on this exit. And then also Exit One to imply that there are many, many future exits down the line.
The idea of bringing in other kind of musical styles, where did that come from?
It was sort of organic in that way that I just started working with some people and I really liked the sound. And so that sort of inspired me to bring in different genres of music. And I also learned so much about music through the other musicians that I work with and their styles. And my goal was to really showcase Indian classical music in a way that is appealing to a wider audience, and so they can get an interest in it and find the beauty that I see in it.
Well, speaking of which, I think you're going to play another piece for us.
Shivanjani is based on a melody that I learned going to my temple growing up in Texas. I left Texas a number of years ago, and it's just kind of stayed with me over the years and sort of like haunted me. And I decided I wanted to use the melody to create a song, and I expanded the melody and added a cello part and brought in Cristals in the beatbox instead of using a traditional drum, which would be the tabla. So that's kind of how that song came about.
All right, let's hear it.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was really fun. It sure would be interesting to hear you perform in India.
I would love to do that. Hopefully that's on the horizon.
Do your audiences, it's interesting, I'm curious about what kinds of audiences come to see you.
I think a lot of Indian people, which one? You know, in my age group, and working with Chris Stiles, I think it's exposed me to his audience, which has been really great, because most people that come to see him don't even know what Indian classical music is.
Chris Stiles Bacon is the beatbox artist. I was curious how you learned your part.
For the piece, Sharanjani, this is like a piece where she's giving me the freedom to create my part to it. The other piece that we do often, Pida V Beatbox, that piece I had to actually learn the instrument, tabla, and the rhythms, and then try to adapt that to the human beatbox technique.
Impressive. The other thing I noticed is that, unlike in the Western tradition where a violinist would be standing or possibly, you know, leaning on a high stool, you're sitting cross-legged.
Right.
And so is Chris Stiles. He's sitting here cross-legged too. And I just wondered if that required any adjustment of how you hold your body to play.
When I switched over to Indian classical violin, it was definitely an adjustment for me because I was used to holding it up, standing or sitting in a chair. But I've gotten used to it now. But there's a reason why I hold the violin this way. And it's because having the scroll resting on my ankle allows the flexibility for me to do this technique, which is called meend, which is sliding of the notes instead of going straight to it and having the fingerboard pointed down. It allows me the flexibility to do that. So that's one reason why we sit that way. And then also the music is also in tune with nature and feelings, and we respect Mother Earth, so we sit on the floor. And Chris has been kind enough to join me when we perform together down here on the floor.
So. It seems like his body's still adjusting. He's still getting used to it.
One day.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. When you were growing up learning classical violin in the Western tradition, as well as the Indian classical tradition, I just wondered if you ever envisioned what you're doing now.
No, I actually didn't. I just kind of knew that music was something that I had to follow. I just sort of always had faith in that, and other than other things in my life that I'm so uncertain about, but I know music for sure is something that I need to keep in the center of my life.
Nishtha Raj is an Indian-American artist. Her debut album is titled Exit One, and she was kind enough to join us along with her bandmates in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much for joining us. That's Bhairavi Beatbox from Nishtha Raj's debut album, Exit One. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.